The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the A16Z podcast. I'm Sonal. Today, General Partner Peter Levine and I are chatting with Jan Stoica, who's the director of the new RISE Lab at UC Berkeley, formerly known as AMP Lab, where he was the co-director and which we've talked a bit about on this podcast. Jan also founded Databricks and served as its CEO for the first few years and has played a seminal role in multiple startups that have come out of the Berkeley Data Analytics or Badass stack. So we wanted to get his thoughts on the ingredients of successful labs, given the evolution of academia, research, and industry, as well as discuss open source and the role of community and what comes next after big data, given AI.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jan, you've played super interesting roles, both on the academic front and on the commercial front. And often those two areas are often in conflict with one another. And you're one of these people who has very successfully sort of embodied those two different characteristics. How do you do that? And what do you think the relationship is between one or the other? And how do you get that to work so well?
I'm going to make a little joke here and say, how do you do it all?
I'm super interested in the answer.
Yeah, that's a great question. And there are many dimensions, many interactions. I do think at a high level, academia, it's allowing you to do more experimentation. It's set for that. And at Berkeley, we are in a privileged position, of course, being close to the Silicon Valley. We have a lot of feedback from the industry. So we are very anchored in what are the real problems. Then it's a very natural to transition some of this work to industry and to, you know, students and sometimes faculty starting companies around this project.
I'd just be curious, like, how did AMP Lab start? How did that come about? How that evolved into RISE?
So first, let me start by saying how the labs are structured at Berkeley, because it's something unique. And this goes back 30 years ago. So the labs are like one rule is around 5 years.
So there's a limit.
There is a limit. So then each lab has particular vision and goals. So in particular, for instance, the AMP Lab, the vision was to make sense of the big data. And the goal is to build the next generation analytics stack to be used across industry and academia.
Around big data, there were three projects that really were notable outputs of the AMP Lab. One, of course, is Spark, which is the basis of Databricks.
Like, how do you describe Spark?
It's a big data execution engine.
The other project, of course, was Mesos, and that resulted in the company Mesosphere.
And what is Mesos?
It's a resource management systems which allow multiple cluster computing framework to share the same cluster, the same hardware.
And the other project that came out of the AMP Lab was a project called Tachyon, which now resulted in a company called Alluxio.
It's an in-memory storage engine, which allow, again, multiple cluster computer frameworks to share the data in memory.
Okay, so this goes back to what you were saying about how each of the labs at Berkeley is set up with a vision, and this is the vision of the big data ecosystem and what's coming next, and it all kind of comes together.
All these components are part of the stack.
I found it very interesting. While this was a big data stack as envisioned by the folks working on these projects, each of these projects has more expansive use than just in the individual use case that was originally envisioned. Mesos, as an example, is not just for big data. It's a resource orchestration framework that can be used for any resource, right? And so the commercial applicability of these projects has a derivative effect of them being more applicable beyond just requiring that these three things work together, and that's the only way that these things can work together.
There are multiple layers of the stack. So actually, Mesos was the first project we developed. This is what started the stack. And Mesos was by design to support multiple cluster computing framework. We started with Hadoop. And actually, one of the reasons we designed Spark is to show that it's much easier to build from ground up a new cluster computer engine on top of Mesos, that without in the absence of Mesos.
Right.
Because Mesos will provide a bunch of services, detecting whether the nodes go down and restarting some of the tasks and things like that, providing isolation between different cluster computing frameworks and others.
Going back to this idea of how the lab, the ingredients that make the Berkeley lab work. So one of them was that they have a vision, that they have this time limit of 5 years.
Yes.
Is there an architect, like a person who sits at the top and says, here's how we're going to do it? Or is it that the students come up with projects?
How does that work? Claim that there is someone which puts a stack in day one and this is what it is. The truth is that things are going to evolve more organically. You have the major functionality and kind of you know how it fits, but then as you encounter it, you better understand the kind of problems you are going to solve, the industry want to solve, and then once you understand and you solve the problems, other problems pop up. You didn't even know existed when you started the entire process.
And many of these projects also, are they all research projects by PhD students? Is there a requirement that they have to be?
All are started and they are research project led by the PhD student.
So I have a question about that, because one of the things that I've always thought about when it comes to this tension between academia and industry, you might hear about needs and requirements from industry, but when you're in research environment, you have unlimited, open-ended, you know, vision. An algorithm in a research paper is very different than something in production at industry scale. So how do you guys navigate that?
First of all, students, they do internships, they understand the problem, they develop the first solutions. And then with that understanding, you can start more principled designs to build these systems. But the truth is that in every successful project, we had at least one or two partners. For instance, we work very closely initially with Facebook. When we started working with Facebook, you know, the entire cluster, big cluster for big data, it was 18 nodes, and their big data team was like 3 people. Then, for instance, in the case of Mesos, we work very closely with Twitter. Ben Hinman went to Twitter and worked very closely with Twitter engineer to deploy Mesos in production. And actually the feedback from Twitter has a big impact on the Mesos evolution. From just supporting big data cluster computing frameworks like Hadoop, it went to support these long-running services.
Yeah. It actually strikes me that in your list of ingredients of what makes Berkeley Lab special, besides what we listed so far, and you alluded to this earlier, there is that proximity to industry, physical, geographic proximity. It's not an accident that Silicon Valley and other ecosystems around the world grow up around these universities. And there's something that goes in university-industry collaboration back and forth, even for the professors, because you were able to go into a company and then go back.
Yeah. The other thing about what AmLab and all these labs have done is that they take a very strong stand about being open source, and we generate no patents. This is one thing we say explicitly and we are very clear about when we engage any partners.
This is true, by the way, at Stanford, too. I think both Berkeley and Stanford have this in common. You guys don't care so much about patenting.
I think it's true now about many universities, but Berkeley has this very long tradition of being open source, even on open source or not fashionable. Unix BSD, for instance, you know, it's coming from there.
Because of that leadership that Berkeley has shown in open source, I would argue that the entire industry now has come around on this stuff, and that the nature of collaboration and the nature of open source being a basis for innovation in software has really become a predominant guiding point in software development and building companies as a result of that. Where in the past, open source was seen as a fringe thing at one point in the past. And, you know, innovation would occur within the walls of large organizations. And now, because of the work that Berkeley has done for years around open source, we see, you know, that as being the engine of innovation for much of the software landscape today.
This is very true. It didn't happen overnight. And of course, it was not only Berkeley. There are many other centers of producing high-quality open-source software. For instance, Zen, you are very familiar with.
Cambridge. Of course.
I had no idea Cambridge was big on open source. I think of Berkeley, MIT,
MIT, and Carnegie Mellon. But what happens is like it's a tipping point now, right? Yeah. Over the past 5-10 years, we are witnessing the tipping point where now you go to try to sell services to the companies and say, are they open source?
Well, the element, I believe, that has brought open source from fringe hobby project out of academia to mainstream
is
the fact that you can actually build commercial businesses on top of open source. And
right.
a lot of that, which you guys at Databricks are doing and many other companies, GitHub is another example, these hosted offerings that leverage open source has given a very clear path to sort of marry the innovation with open source with the ability to monetize, which is very important from a commercial standpoint. And that, you know, up until sort of the cloud and being able to, you know, and SaaS, there wasn't a clear path to go do that. And now that's sort of the best of both worlds.
I think it's worth putting a little bold on this, that when you talk about innovation, you're essentially crowdsourcing the best developers
Correct.
And the best R&D in the world. Because what's that famous line about all the best people never will work for you? And in fact, at Berkeley, Henry Chesbro, Hank, is there, and he talks a lot about open innovation. You have to collaborate with the outside worlds outside your company walls to be successful. The most interesting thing I saw this past week is this stat that Microsoft now has more commits to GitHub than any other company. And can you just think about that for a moment? Like Microsoft on GitHub.
It's not only Microsoft. If you think about 5 years ago, Google, everything was closed source.
At Google? I always thought Google was kind of a pioneer in the open source world.
It's more recently, right, with mm-hmm. Kubernetes and others, TensorFlow, they went open source. But this is relatively recently. If you think about the MapReduce and Google File System, which really started the big data movement.
Right. It was like the precursor to Hadoop
and
then Spark.
And that's why enabled Hadoop to be developed as an open source alternative to Google File System and Google's MapReduce. It's another sign of the tipping point, the fact that all these big companies developing primarily closed source software and products, now they are far more active in the open source community. And one thing I want to mention here is you have to build a community. That goes back to your point about you need this collaboration. So all these successful open source projects, they have a strong community. And I think that's also another thing which helps, because people kind of understand better now how to build these communities. There are more examples out there.
Is it just engineers and research students? Like, how do you think of community managers? Because I know companies invest in those functions.
Absolutely. So first of all, the way these Berkeley Labs are happening, twice per year, there is a retreat, 3 days retreat, where people from Berkeley, students, faculty, and industry people from our sponsors come together and we present the earliest work and we get feedback. So it's a very...
That's another ingredient to add to the list.
It's a fantastic event. Now, what we done, we started what we called camps. We have the AMP camp. We do exactly trying to foster building the community. We have not only presenting our work, but we have tutorials. We train them to work with on our latest software, not always stable.
Right.
But
the beta,
you know,
the beta, alpha,
the beta,
actually,
alpha,
not even alpha, the beta,
alpha,
right?
Alpha, pre-alpha.
Pre-alpha.
And so that also helps to foster the community. And these are natural precursors of these summits.
Well, actually, I was going to say, it reminds me, another example of this collaboration between industry, academia, and other players is what O'Reilly did with open source, and they're
Absolutely.
Starting a Foo camp and various other camps. It's sort of the same kind of thing. And so it's really
right.
interesting because these ideas are permeating both ways into the system.
So it's super interesting to hear about the labs and what happens at Berkeley and the integration between academia and business. So now you're starting or have just started the RISE Lab. What's that all about?
What does it stand for?
It stands for Real-Time Intelligent Secure Execution.
Real-Time Intelligence Secure Execution. That's actually quite a handful. I get why you're calling it RISE instead of saying that as a mouthful otherwise.
It's mouthful, yes. So if you think about putting in the context of the AMP Lab was about analytics.
And by the way, what did AMP stand for?
AMP is Algorithms, Machine, People. It was about interactive ad hoc analytics doing much better than before on large amounts of data.
Yeah.
Getting insights. When you say making sense of the big data, you are talking about understanding, getting insights. What RiseLab is, it's about making intelligent decision, taking intelligent actions on the data. People have a lot of data, get more and more data, and then what do they want to do with this data? The first step is getting some insights on the data, computing some metrics, KPIs, but the next thing is to take decisions, right?
Yeah. This is a holy grail.
This is a holy grail, absolutely, right? So you want to do medical diagnosis. You want to see whether a transaction is fraudulent or not. You want to see where to steer next a car, a self-driving car, right? And of course, you want to see, to know what ad you are going or news you are going to show to the user next, right?
And then it's sort of predicting the future.
Always. With the best decision, you have to predict the future.
Yeah,
right?
That's
the definition almost. Yeah. And then you ask yourself, what is a good decision, right?
What is a good decision? That's a very existential question.
It needs to be fast, right? Because faster decisions are better than slower decisions. It needs to be on the most recent data. I want to make a decision based on what happens now.
By most recent as in the realest timest data out there.
Right? Rather than what happens yesterday.
Or even an hour ago, we're talking real time.
It needs to be personalized. You see about this hyper-personalization. It's clear it's here to stay. So this basically defines the goals, because we want to make the decision on live data and we want to make the decision which are secure. Why? Because if I am making personally a decision, then the question is, what about the privacy? Okay. So then you want to make personal decision while preserving the privacy, while preserving data confidentiality. And of course, because the decision, if happens in real time, in some cases, the humans may not be in the loop. So you need to ensure the integrity of the decisions. And then there are two other things about the decision which are very important. One is robustness. The human is not the loop, better the decision can be robust. There are many dimensions of robustness. It's about robustness to noisy input. Is raining as a camera doesn't capture the same kind of high quality images.
Or in a real life example, like if you don't detect a heart attack and it's something else.
Totally. It needs to be also robust on some parts of the system failed, some component failed. But also it needs to be robust to unforeseen input. So let me give you an example. Today, it's easy to have an algorithm to try to recognize cats and dogs. You do that and it's pretty good, very accurate. But now I show this algorithm, an elephant. What you want the algorithm to say is, I don't know, I'm not sure. Needs to provide some confidence interval on these decisions. Because then, for instance, if you are a self-driving car, that you can pop up and let tell the driver to take over or make a safe decision. Slow down and stop. That's one about robustness. The last one, it's explainability. As we make decisions which augment the ability of humans to make more sophisticated decisions or take decisions on behalf of humans, like a self-driving car.
Right.
Explainability, it's very important. Think about a very simple example. You go to the doctor and you have the x-ray, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now actually there are very good algorithms which goes take that x-ray and give you a diagnosis. But would you be satisfied with the diagnosis?
No,
not necessarily.
Someone to hold your hand and tell you more about it.
Yes. So that's what it is. You want to know why. This is how people start to trust a decision. Like even if your friends or spouse makes a decision which affects you and kind of is unexpected, what is your first question? Why did you make that decision?
Well, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that AmpLab, in evolving to RiseLab, it's actually setting it up for decision-making, as you're describing with all these characteristics. But more importantly, it's big data moving into AI, and the world of science and tech is moving in this direction.
There is no question about that. AI, there are, over the past 5 years, great results. When we look at the PhD students who apply to Berkeley, PhD applicants, it turns out that well over 60% are applying for AI.
I have a pushback here, though. How then is a new lab at Berkeley relevant in a world where companies are now kind of creating their own labs in-house to really put together a lot of the same skills, PhDs, et cetera? And in thinking through like this sort of connection to industry, especially because one of the complaints I hear all the time is about how there are a majority of AI papers are actually algorithms. And we actually need a lot more tools and tooling to actually take that information and make decisions on it.
Totally. Now, I think that it's an excellent question and it's a challenge, but you know, sometimes the challenges are motivating.
Those are the best kind.
So the goal of the Arise Lab, it is to build open source platforms, tools, and algorithms to enable these intelligent real-time decisions on live data with strong security. So this will fit some of the holes you mentioned.
Right.
And it's true. Many of the algorithms which are published are hard to reproduce. So that's one part of the question. We see that need. Now, the other part of the question, you say, well, look, Google or Microsoft or even now Chinese companies, Baidu's and so forth.
I was just thinking of Baidu, actually, when you said that.
Spend huge amount of resources, and you have also OpenAI, huge amount of resources. So how can you make a difference? I think that's always happened. It's about AI, but in the past, it was about operating system. It was about, you know,
computing, personal computing. What was Xerox computer part but an industry lab?
So this all happened. So what I can tell you that what we find is that a lot of large companies and partners, consumers of AI, or they want to be, we have financial companies like Capital One, we have IoT like Ericsson, mm-hmm. we have Huawei, we have Ant Financial.
Which is Alibaba's payments arm, right?
It's Alibaba is doing far more than payments.
Oh, I know.
So on one hand, you know, these companies, they would prefer to have a very strong open source stack they could use.
That's right. Not solely right. The province of a single company.
Microsoft and Google of the world, which they have very strong team of the AI. They have hardware, right? Powering AI algorithms. What we have is more research collaboration. Even they cannot explore all the potential, say, design choices.
I would think that one of the things that you have as an advantage that companies do not is that you have a much different risk profile than a company. Earlier, one of the things you said is that the purpose of a lab is to do experiments. And one of the questions that I have is, in this day and age, a lot of startups and big companies do experiments in different ways.
On the Rise Lab, even faculty don't have offices. They open floor. We have, you know, it's like sitting side by side, AI people, system people, and database people, architecture people.
Companies have tried experiments like that and they don't work because it's hard to get people to just suddenly start collaborating because you stick them in a room together. That is something that big companies cannot easily do. They're siloed by function.
How many projects do you envision running concurrently at Rise? Is there a limit or how do you guys?
It's not really a limit. It's again more organic. And there are different kind of projects. There are projects which hope to become a strong artifact to be used across in industry, like Spark or Mesos or Tachyon. And there are more explorative projects which will remain at the stage of the prototyping. But you try to categorize. So, you know, you look at this kind of big, broad categories of problems and try to develop solution for this problem.
I don't know if you ever looked at one of my blogs. I did the end of cloud computing, right? And the return to the edge and distributed computing. A lot of data now gets collected at the edge. It's real world information.
A lot of decisions are happening there.
A lot of decisions are happening at the edge. A self-driving car is an edge data center where decisions need to be get made. And so I'm curious, are there projects that you guys think about related to that?
That's a great question. So indeed, that we are really looking at building systems which span the cloud and edge. And I think they're going to be both ways. Things which are now done at the cloud is going to migrate some of the functionality on the edge. Also, on the other side, things which are now done only at the edge, like self-driving cars, will migrate. Some of the functionality will migrate to the cloud.
So it's vice versa. It goes, you're saying that both things are moving to the edge and things in the edge are moving to the center. I feel like there's a poem in there somewhere. What is that? The things fall apart. I just remember the classic poem.
One of the really interesting things. So I started to become like, what happens when something ends, right? But now I'm going a step further to the future of computing because I believe that programming is sort of the life cycle of programming is sort of at the end. Like you can only write so many if-then-else statements. You're kind of done with logic, right?
Yeah.
In that sense. And all this purification of data and the input of data into a system as a as a precursor to an observation that's happening in real world information is sort of the future of computing and iteration.
And you close the loop, right?
Correct. Yes. We talk so much about programming, but I think that your lab is the exact example of academia being proactive in the new world of data as opposed to coding. Right.
Absolutely.
And new methods of academic research will need to be developed in order to promote data as a functional input to computing.
Yeah, think about that. You start again. Some of the application of this new AI, research, like for instance, reinforcement learning, it's about synthesizing programs.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Any other work that you think is interesting?
One called Ray, and it's to build a cluster computing framework which make it easier to build the next generation of AI application. One example is reinforcement learning. This reinforcement learning, it's about agents which continuously interact with the environment and learn from this interaction with the environment. If you think of a car, it's about an agent interacting, taking decisions,
the driver
which will
agent,
affect
right.
the real world and learning from these interactions. The other project is Clipper. It's about model serving. Once you create these models, you need to serve them to users. You'd learn and, you know, they make the request about showing this image to do the image recognition. And this is a hard problem. It's multiple levels. How do you scale the life cycle management of the model serving? How you are going to update the models? How you are going to improve this
Why
model over time?
Why is that such
time?
A hard problem right now?
Well, because the models you developed on some data set. And for instance, the data or the queries are going to evolve over time. And because the environment or the world around you evolves, what you learned and which is embedded in the model may not be as relevant or as good as it used to be. So that's one example. The other work I would mention, it's in area of security. We have the project called Opaque. It's also related with Spark. It's about how you do analytics, for instance, in the cloud so that you can defend against any kind of attacks, even if the operating system is compromised or the hypervisor, the virtual machine is compromised, the data and the computation is secure.
And is it because they're kept separate?
This uses these hardware enclaves.
Oh, interesting.
Which are now in more and more processors, CPUs, like Intel SGX ARM Trust Zone. So it's using these new developments in the hardware. And finally, one other project is Ground. And this is about to try to understand the semantics, the provenance, the lineage of the data.
Oh, interesting.
Who created certain data, data item? Who did modify that data item? Who did look at those data items? And this the goal is to provide this service across multiple data sources, across multiple data storage systems.
I love this. It's like data provenance as a service. You know, I'd ask you about how you guys came up with the names for all those projects, because I'm always fascinated by the naming of things. One of the funniest stories that Michael Franklin told me about AmpLab is that when you guys were coming up with the name, that Dave Patterson wrote an email going, why are you guys being all backward about this? That you guys should instead take a first principles approach to what you want the qualities to be and then come up with the acronym instead of, you know, the other way around. You must have had some debates around how to end up on RISE.
Patterson has two rules. One, it's good to be a four-letter name. So
really?
Are qualifying them.
Rate. Didn't he come up with that too?
Yeah.
What's rate?
Rate.
Redundant array of inexpensive disks. Yeah, he was the inventor of like all this striping and streaming and parody bits and all this stuff.
So it's RISC, RAID, hopefully RISE now.
That's hilarious.
The other one starts with R. So we are checking
that box as
well.
So you guys ignored him
well.
The first time around, and now you're like, okay, we're going to start with R. And so how did you guys sort of land on RISE? Did you guys just like literally like throw up like, you know, that this is where we're going and here's all the qualities that we need to capture?
Actually started with what are the attributes, so what do you want to do.
It's like a good branding exercise.
That was a good exercise.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and thanks very much for educating us on kind of this intersection of academia and business.
Thank you for joining the A6NZ podcast,
Thank you for having me.